I think we live in a time period in general where the law is sort of seen as the highest sort of moral good or political good. But who comes up with the law? It's obviously those in power. And of course, there's an incredible body of work that examines how the law itself has worked to entrench the status quo, enable colonial hierarchies, restrict the potential for anti-colonial organizing. And more than ever, we see today that even those who create the law are not actually held accountable to it, even though colonized communities around the world are expected to uphold it.
Spaces that are completely segregated and racialized.
What it is like to be, you know, queer and Arab, and how difficult that might be, or how do you negotiate that?
The destruction of the social cultural worlds of Black people, of African people, those who are here before.
Which kinds of bodies get disciplined and regulated through discourse, but also in actual practice?
Hi, I'm Maigrida Waku.
I'm Caroline Honorian.
And I'm Leopold Lambert. This is a Phenomenalist podcast operating in parallel with a Phenomenalist magazine that engages with the politics of space and bodies.
Our hope is to provide a useful platform where activists, academics, and practitioners build solidarities across geographical scales.
Each episode, we invite someone we admire and learn from their experiences, research, and struggle.
So the Kashmir struggle has not been, you know, for all of these decades, has not been to actually implement or actualize Article 370, but challenges the very fundamental idea that India would even have any legal claims on Kashmir. But unfortunately, because of the ways in which the law gets deployed, it's very difficult to kind of see beyond the legal frameworks, especially in this kind of international order that relies on legal justifications for political claims.
Spaces that are completely segregated and racialized.
What it is like to be, you know, queer and Arab, and how difficult that might be, or how do you negotiate that?
The destruction of the social cultural worlds of Black people, of African people, those who are here before.
Which kinds of bodies get disciplined and regulated through discourse, but also in actual practice?
Hi, I'm Maigrida Waku.
I'm Caroline Honorian.
And I'm Leopold Lambert. This is a Phenomenalist podcast operating in parallel with a Phenomenalist magazine that engages with the politics of space and bodies.
Our hope is to provide a useful platform where activists, academics, and practitioners build solidarities across geographical scales.
Each episode, we invite someone we admire and learn from their experiences, research, and struggle.
Hi everyone, salam. I'm Shivangi Maryam Raj for this episode of the Phenomenalist podcast. Today I'm joined by Hafsa Kanjwal, whose work has been crucial for many of us over the last few years. She's an assistant professor of South Asian history in the Department of History at Lafayette College in Eastern Pennsylvania, where she teaches courses on the history of the modern world, South Asian history, and Islam in the modern world. Hafsa is the author of Colonizing Kashmir, State Building Under Indian Occupation, which examines how the Indian and Kashmir governments utilize state building to entrench India's colonial occupation of Kashmir in the aftermath of the partition of the subcontinent in 1947. Our conversation today draws from her book and focuses on the affect and mythologies deployed by India to condense Kashmir into a landscape of desire, into a territory of control, on slow and invisibilized forms of violence embedded in the infrastructures of assimilation, on the complex forms of state crafting under successive client regimes that have contributed to the strengthening of India's settler colonial project in Kashmir today. We also discuss methods of resistance practiced by the peoples of Jammu and Kashmir, and how they help us think about liberation in the global landscape of post-colonial colonialism. Salam, Hafsa. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we know how the demand for Azadi has routinely been pathologized across the ideological spectrum in India, with Kashmiris being labeled as ill, impractical, sentimental, ungrateful, stubborn, deviant, or terror threats. The list goes on, really. And there is also the infantilizing trope deployed by the right and the left liberal forces in equal measure, with the former claiming that Kashmiris are children who deserve to be punished, while the latter insists that Kashmiris are children who need to be loved and brought back home. And I'm also thinking about how the term Atut Ang combines anatomy with cartographic anxieties. So could you tell us about the project of Indonesian state and how it has depended on such vocabularies to establish and sustain itself over the last seven decades?
Yes, sure. So Atut Ang basically means integral part, and Indian leaders and the general public say this time and again. You'll hear it each time India's rule in Kashmir is either challenged or criticized. Immediately, the narrative that's used is Kashmir is an integral part of India. And so this in particular relies on a misreading of history, both about the ancient period, but also around the time of the 1947 partition, in order to make these claims. And the repetition of integral part denies the fact that Kashmir has historically been at the crossroads of multiple regions, regions that have now been circumscribed into South Asia or Central Asia or East Asia. In fact, places like Kashmir actually defy the ease in which we ourselves have become bounded by these colonial or national cartographies. And what you mentioned about the right versus liberal left forces is also really important, because whether it's Nehruvian secularists in India or the Hindu nationalists, when it comes to Kashmir, the end goal is the same: to affirm Kashmiri nationalism over the Kashmiri, or sorry, to affirm Indian nationalism over the Kashmiri subject. So they may vary in their approach. For example, the left liberal strand thinks that India should work harder to emotionally integrate Kashmiri so that they don't become further alienated, whereas the Hindu nationalist doesn't really care to do that and simply wishes to integrate the region forcefully without even a pretense of caring about what Kashmiris want or think. And so the ways in which Kashmiri demands for Azadi or freedom are vilified and infantilized by the Indian state reflect those very same European attitudes towards their colonies, that, for example, they weren't ready for freedom, that they couldn't self-govern, and that colonialism was in effect better for them. India very much relies on these same logics. And of all of these characteristics or vocabulary that India uses, I think ungrateful is especially interesting for me. Whenever Kashmiris would come to the streets and protest, Indian commentators would be aghast that even after all the funds that India spends in Kashmir, that people would still take to the streets. And what's interesting to me is that this is a complete denial of the very reason why these excessive funds even existed, which was in effect to buy out Kashmiris, and how it just simply didn't work. The Indian state will also use the narrative of corruption to talk about how Kashmiris are corrupt, and that's why India needs to, you know, be there to kind of clean up the place. Without, you know, the fact of the matter is that India actually used corruption as a means of entrenching its control in Kashmir, and then slapped those very same client regimes that it basically put into power for becoming too corrupt. So these are, I think, just vocabularies that you can see, you know, not just in Kashmir, but are also kind of used across a number of different colonial contexts.
That brings me to my second question. So how has India weaponized nostalgia, in particular Nehruvian nostalgia, to consolidate its colonial infrastructure in Kashmir? Your work foregrounds the occupation strategy of elimination via assimilation deployed using the seemingly harmless or as they say, humanitarian modalities of democracy, development, and secularism. So what specific forms of control do they produce?
Yeah, so one of the main takeaways I want people to get from this book is that settler colonialism, and occupation do not only rely on necropolitical forms of control, meaning the management of death, and nor do they just rely on the dispossession or marginalization of a colonized people. Elimination can also occur by assimilation, where the idea is to basically rid the people of their own sense of history, identity, and bring them into line with the settler state. And so only seeing colonialism as being defined by manifest violence obscures our understandings of the other ways in which it can operate through things like democracy, development, and secularism. And these are attributes that often have a very positive valence, and yet they are precisely what consolidated India's colonial occupation of Kashmir. So, for example, democracy was deployed as an attempt to deny Kashmiri self-determination by saying that electoral politics replaced the plebiscite that Kashmiris were promised by the UN. Development was used to show the benefit that the Indian state was providing Kashmiris, as well as create a dependency on the Indian state, which sought to depoliticize political aspirations and make Kashmiri subjectivities on a spectrum between collaboration and resistance. And finally, secularism was used to erase Muslim histories of Kashmir and foreground Hindu ones in an attempt again to showcase that Kashmir was integral to India, which itself is being constructed as Hindu in this time. So in my research, I observed how India engaged with both these kind of humanitarian modalities as well as more necropolitical modalities of control in Kashmir, sometimes even at the same time. And while, you know, one may think that a state governing through death or life may appear to be in contradiction, it's actually not. The idea is to entrench colonial rule, to transform political subjectivities. And depending on the context, this can be done through violence, or what we often see as violence, or more through strategic kind of policies of winning hearts and minds. And I often think that the war on terror is a really interesting kind of comparative perspective as well, because it also used more necropolitical forms such as black sites or torture or Guantanamo Bay. But then it also used the language of state building, development, and these more humanitarian forms of governance to completely transform people's political and economic subjectivities to benefit Western or US empire and capital.
Right. And often nebulous nomenclatures of legality can trap us in creating a distinction between legal and illegal forms of violence, between permissible and forbidden methods of violence, etc. We notice this especially when references are made to Indian armed forces' use of specific weapons or torture techniques. And we also noticed this when India unilaterally abrogated Articles 370 and 35A of the Indian Constitution, stripping Jammu and Kashmir of its semi-autonomous status, accelerating its settler colonial project, and engendering demographic change in the region. And all that the liberal commentaries had to say about it was to say simply that it's an unconstitutional move. So what do you think explains this refusal to understand Kashmir beyond the Indian legal frameworks?
I think we live in a time period in general where the law is sort of seen as the highest sort of moral good or political good. But who comes up with the law? It's obviously those in power. And of course, there's an incredible body of work that examines how the law itself has worked to entrench the status quo, enable colonial hierarchies, restrict the potential for anti-colonial organizing. And more than ever, we see today that even those who create the law are not actually held accountable to it, even though colonized communities around the world are expected to uphold it. So I think part of what is happening in the Kashmir case is that with the law in particular, is that so much of the discourse on Kashmir surrounds 1947 and the Treaty of Accession by the last Dogra monarch, Hari Singh, to the Indian state. And so India relies on this legal claim that, you know, this Treaty of Accession was signed, and thus India has a legal claim over Kashmir. And so the discussion itself then revolves around whether or not the treaty was valid, not valid, signed under duress, or so on. Instead of actually thinking, well, why should Kashmiris, you know, their claim to, or why should the claim to Kashmir be based on a treaty that the vast majority, of course, the people themselves did not have any say in. And then we have another legal framework, the Indian Constitution and Article 370, which was supposed to have granted Kashmir autonomy. And despite this appearance of autonomy, Kashmir scholars have argued that Article 370 itself was a colonial treaty because it was evident that the Indian leadership never saw it as a permanent arrangement, and also that it was a stopgap until things calmed down after the first India-Pakistan war. And the goal eventually was for India to fully integrate Kashmir into its union. And even after signing Article 370, India began to go beyond the law, its own kind of constitutional law, by violating its restricted mandates. And Kashmir scholars Haley Dushinsky and Srimoy Ghosh have called this occupational constitutionalism, whereby the law itself works to entrench occupation. So the issue is that legal frameworks in many ways also restrict demands for liberation. Just a few weeks ago, there was a Supreme Court hearing on whether the removal of Article 370 was illegal or unconstitutional. And these debates and discussions basically deflect from questions of liberation and freedom. And they also change the goalpost for the colonized as well. So the Kashmir struggle has not been, you know, for all of these decades, has not been to actually implement or actualize Article 370, but challenges the very fundamental idea that India would even have any legal claims on Kashmir. But unfortunately, because of the ways in which the law gets deployed, it's very difficult to kind of see beyond the legal frameworks, especially in this kind of international order that relies on legal justifications for political claims.
So these days I've been thinking about what I call the politics of temporal determinism, where we notice how much of colonial state crafting is contingent on governing the past, how history is narrated, how memories are regulated, on expelling the occupied, the minoritized, from their own futures, where time itself becomes a site of violence, and where time is actively extracted and stolen. And there's a particular phrase in your book which I really liked, and I feel that it helps me expand this idea from the perspective of Kashmir. The part wherein you write how the successive client regimes in Kashmir have paradoxically propagated a land that was both modern and timeless. And I feel that this is how this is how time is distorted, and this is what leads also to manufacturing the myth of normalcy in Kashmir. So I would like you to talk a bit about the specific ways in which Kashmir is produced and circulated as a landscape and as a territory under normalcy, and how it is different from the hyper-visible acts of violence that target Kashmiri homes and bodies.
So in addition to repeating, you know, ad nauseum that Kashmir is integral to India, the Indian state also repeats that from time to time that Kashmir is normal. And normalization is actually integral to the processes of colonization, settler colonialism, and occupation. It belies the immense amount of violence that's actually inherent in the production of normalcy. And where there is such a strong attempt to produce normalcy, it usually means that things are actually not that normal. And we can see the parallels of the time period that we're in today with the time period that I was looking at in the 1950s and the 1960s. And basically what the production of normalcy relies on is that you know, this narrative that everything in Kashmir is fine, it's secure, people are content under Indian rule, India has everything under control. And my book looks at how this normalcy was basically manufactured in three particular ways. One was through media, another through film, and another through tourism. And what's been interesting is to kind of see how all three played a role in the production of normalcy, and they continue to do so up until today. So we can maybe think about how this looks when it comes to the media. In the 1950s and 1960s, Indian journalists would go to Kashmir and report on the kinds of developments that the client regime that was in power at the time was embarking upon. And so they would speak about Kashmir in a very positive way, focusing on development, on progress. And of course, there was no mention of the immense amount of political repression that Kashmiris were subject to. And the idea was to show that India was bringing progress to Kashmir and that Indian rule was beneficial for Kashmiris. And so, India wanted for Kashmir to be depicted as thriving under Indian rule. And media narratives really played an important role in this. And it was not just Indian media which partook in this. Even international press at that time was kind of mobilized for this as well. For some time, there was international critique of India in the early 1950s because India had not actually, the plebiscite was still alive and India was not holding it. And so in the UK and in the US press, there were critiques of Nehru and what the Indian government was doing in Kashmir. But from the mid-1950s and so on, international reporters who would come to Kashmir were again shown this kind of production of normalcy. They were made to visit schools, tourism centers, infrastructure projects. And at the end of their visits, many basically concluded that at least some level of development was underway. And so Kashmiris, India had managed to bring normalcy to Kashmir. And so people were on board with the Indian kind of state project. And so even today, repeatedly, almost every year, there's articles in the Indian media about how there's tourism in Kashmir and how high numbers of Indian tourists in Kashmir basically mean that normalcy has returned. And so this is kind of a repetition of things that the state and the client regimes have relied on in the past as well. In the 1950s and 60s, many Indian films were set in Kashmir, and the leading actresses and actors of the time would come, and Indian viewers of these films would basically see a place that was incredibly beautiful, colorful, the natural beauty, and so it kind of created this desire on the behalf of kind of the general Indian public for this place, right? This colonial space that India was making a claim over, it created a desire for that. But it also just, showed people or kind of also promoted tourism. So as people are watching these films, they also want to go to Kashmir. They want to stay in houseboats, they want to visit the lakes, mountains, and so on. So part of what films do is, one, project normalcy, because the very fact that films are being produced in Kashmir means that things are safe and people are happy, so on. But they also, in addition to that, they also kind of create this claim or this desire that Indians have over the Kashmiri landscape in particular, which again contributes to the idea that this is an integral part of India.
So your work powerfully challenges Indian scholarship on Kashmir across nationalist, post-colonial, and subaltern studies articulations, all of which have always diminished Kashmir to an analytic category, a category that always remains subservient to the sacred logics of the nation state. Could you tell us more about how their work has simultaneously obscured and strengthened the Indian colonial project?
Yeah, so many nationalist, post-colonial, and subaltern scholars of India are kind of fundamentally committed to a methodological nationalism, which basically naturalizes the Indian nation state form across history and denies its coloniality. And many also tend to refer to Kashmir as either an ethnic nationalist movement or a secessionist movement, which again reflects a colonial commitment to the integrity of the Indian nation state form, as well as India's own kind of historical narrative. And so my book builds upon a body of Kashmir scholarship that has, you know, tried to contest these studies of post-colonial or subaltern South Asia, because part of it is, you know, this idea that there is a sanctioned ignorance, which Kashmir scholar Athar Zia says there's like a sanctioned arrogance in which the Kashmir issue and the demands that Kashmiris have been invalidated or overwritten and criminalized by India. And the Subaltern Studies Collective, which often is completely kind of like valorized in scholarly fields, has played a role in this sanctioned ignorance, despite one of its founders, Bivak, coining the term. So my colleague, Mohammed Junaid, actually looked at the different articles that the Subaltern Studies Collective published across its, you know, multiple years of publications. And, you know, even though they tried to look at subaltern subjects within India, they did not look at those subjects that were, you know, outside of the boundaries, or those who were being subjected by the Indian nation state and its colony in Kashmir. And so of the 83 articles published, he found that there was not a single article on Kashmir. And this is in the 1990s, when there's a huge, you know, military presence in Kashmir. There's massive human rights violations that are happening. And that's happening at the same time that the collective itself has gained global recognition. And so whatever little was talked about or mentioned about Kashmir was still kind of subsumed under this idea of India, that this is a part of India. And so this is something that has existed not just with Kashmir, but for so many things, even when you think about how partition is talked about and the creation of the state of Pakistan, it's seen as, you know, that this was a division of a time immemorial India into India and Pakistan, and that the quest for freedom or self-determination of different communities within South Asia or the subcontinent is an aberration to the idea of a unified nation. But I think part of what, you know, people need to kind of understand more is that this idea of India as a nation state is born out of a very particular moment. It could have come about in many different iterations. And so, this methodological nationalism that transplants the Indian nation state and gives it this kind of historical basis across all time and space is really problematic. You know, this is why so much of the scholarship, when it was looking at Kashmir, it was just kind of using really problematic frameworks of either secessionism, A Crisis of Federalism, A Crisis of Indian Democracy, and my favorite by Partha Chatterjee, Internal Colonialism. So you can just see how so many of these scholars are just completely failing to see beyond the nation-state form. And then when you think about it, in some ways, they're also engaging in their own form of, articulating that Kashmir is an integral part of India, that there's no solution for Kashmir outside of the Indian national framework. And so in many ways, most of these scholars are also then complicit in India's colonial occupation, at least in terms of knowledge production, which, of course, as we know, play such a critical role in colonial projects.
Thank you, Hafsa. This brings us to the very last question, where I would like you to take us through some approaches in and methods of resistance that Kashmiris have been practicing over the decades. And now, especially in this moment, we see how post-colonial mythologies are devouring the political aspirations of states in waiting, of nations in refusal. So, in such a landscape, what forms of imaginations does Kashmir open up for us, for all of us?
Yeah, so Kashmiri resistance has ranged from mass mobilizations and protests calling for plebiscite in the 1950s, the 1960s and 70s, to an armed rebellion in the late 1980s, as well as everyday forms of resistance that rejects Indian sovereign control over the Kashmiri mind and body. Kashmiris in Kashmir and those outside have also tried to rewrite the histories that has been written by the colonial powers, to re-narrate themselves into history through scholarship, literature, photography, the arts, and so on. And as we also know from so many other contexts, to exist, to persevere, to hold on to your faith, sense of community, and identity is in and itself a form of resistance as well, which of course Kashmiris have done. I think Kashmir fundamentally challenges the liberal, secular, international order, and the understandings that that order has on sovereignty, or about sovereignty, democracy, the nation state. It's always those on the margins that can offer up some of the best critiques of hegemonic orders. And Kashmir is really no different. In the past couple of months, we've seen how the Israeli genocide of Gaza has also fundamentally revealed the failures of this order. And so I'm not sure really what possibility occupied and colonized peoples like the Palestinians or the Kashmiris, and of course many others, have within this order. In fact, they face further subjugation. And so this is a moment which is actually really important to fundamentally rethink and reimagine the world. I would argue that the most liberatory world modes of world making have to be premised on a rejection of Eurocentric epistemology, and that requires a rethinking of Enlightenment thought and practice, which have otherwise become so normalized, in our everyday way of thinking. And I see Kashmiris doing this in different ways in their writings, art, expressions, and slogans. So, for example, Ahmed bin Qasim, who's a Kashmiri writer and activist, he writes about how, for example, during protests, Kashmiris often use the slogan "Hum kya chahte, Azadi, Azadi ka matlab kya, la ilaha illallah," which translated means "What do we want? Freedom. What is the meaning of freedom? That there's no God but Allah." And so this articulation challenges Eurocentric secularist norms by invoking a model of liberation through and with Islam at the center. But it also rejects the sovereign power of the occupying regime, in this case, India, by declaring the power of the greatest sovereign. And we saw this time and again in Palestine these past few months as well. And so my next scholarly work will be looking at some of these questions of alternate modes of sovereignty. And I'm hoping to draw from, indigenous scholarship, some decolonial scholarship as well, to kind of understand how, these questions have been talked about or addressed in other contexts, but also thinking about decolonization in ways that doesn't necessarily just replicate Eurocentric frameworks, which is what the Third World Project in many ways did. And so I hope in the future I can give you a much better sense or much better kind of answer to this question, because I'm still kind of in the beginning stages of what this could potentially look like, or thinking through what this could potentially look like. But definitely this rethinking needs to happen, especially today.
Thank you, Hafsa. This has been special. Thank you once again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.